The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Orthodox Nationalist. Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is a former professor of Russian and Ukrainian history and philosophy, an Orthodox priest, and a theorist of nationalism and agrarianism. And now, here's Matt.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another edition of The Orthodox Nationalist. And today we're going to deal with economics. For about 15 years, I have been studying the doctrines of G.D.H. Cole, R.W. Taney, and many others that might be called the Guild Socialist or Christian Socialist movement. And we touched on this in the last talk last week on the National Romantics. And I want to hold that the Guild and or Christian Socialist movement, they're very similar, serves as a sort of a third way between capitalism and various forms of Marxism that are out there. Solzhenitsyn had said that capitalism and communism were essentially the same theory. The only difference was a matter of ownership. In communism, the state owns everything. In capitalism, the banks own everything. And the fact is that it remains that capitalism and communism are very much the same. They are both materialist. They are both highly statist. They are based on utility. They're based on production, control over nature, and control over labor. Socialism, in its communist and Marxist sense, was never about worker control. It never was about labor. It was about a party apparatus transferring all the wealth of the society to them. That's what communism was in the Soviet Union and anywhere else that it was tried. And in fact, throughout Soviet history, inequality between the various classes in society began to increase fairly rapidly. Christian socialism is based around an idealistic approach to the High Middle Ages, and specifically the doctrines of the Guild. It is a neo-medievalist movement in the sense that it isn't about bringing back the Middle Ages so much, but it's about learning from the mentality of the High Medieval period in the West for the sake of economic reform. Guild socialism, Christian socialism, these are not revolutionary doctrines. They are gradualist doctrines. They are not materialist. And G.D.H. Cole, who I've been reading for about 20 years, one way or another, I was introduced to G.D.H. Cole when I first read Rousseau's Social Contract. And my translation of that book was by Cole, and Rousseau's writings were edited by Cole. And that was my very first exposure to him. And in grad school, when I became disillusioned with the capitalist system, which of course is not the free market, although it uses the free market to justify itself, I certainly wasn't going to go to Karl Marx or even some of the anarchists like Bakunin. I instead began to study the Christian socialists, Cole and Taney. And I guess to some extent, Dostoevsky referred to himself in the Diary of a Writer as a Christian socialist. And it became for me a way to criticize the Enlightenment industrial capitalist system without having to go to the extremes of the Marxists, who were wrong on many levels. And really the worst level on which they're incorrect is their view of man. And they view man the same way that the capitalists view man. They both come from the same parent. Capitalism and communism are both from the Enlightenment, and therefore they are brothers. And while they differ in certain things, they're identical in terms of their view of man. Man does not have a soul. Man does not have a will. Man merely is a machine that produces things. This production then comes more or less to define the various classes in society. And that's all a man is in Marxism. That's all a man is in capitalism. G.D.H. Cole, Tony, and others who are interested in Christian or guild socialism, first of all, reject the commodity theory of labor. Labor as a commodity, as a thing. Both Marxists and capitalists are identical in this regard, in that there is such a thing as a labor market, and labor can be given a value no different than any other commodity, any other object. Needless to say, that reduces the worker to an object, and it's the same in the Soviet Union as it is in advanced capitalism. The Christian and guild socialist way of thinking begins with the concept of man as having a soul, and as a result of that, having free will. But these people are now under what can only be called an oligarchy who, judging by the organizations that they give their corporate largesse to, is liberal in its political orientation. The National Council on La Raza gets most of its money from corporate America. The NAACP gets most of its money from corporate America. The ACLU gets most of its money from corporate America. And this is the case whether you're looking at the oil firms or entertainment or whatever. They are unabashedly leftist, at least in their general social policy. And one of the biggest myths in American life is that corporate interests are conservative. They are nothing of the kind. They are, to use that label, they are of the left liberal variety, at least in terms of their corporate giving. So we have the worst of all worlds. We have a oligarchy. We have a banking and finance oligarchy that promotes in every way possible the falling apart of the society that it is based upon. They are parasites in the sense that they take wealth from a host that they hate and that they want to see destroyed, or at least weakened. And there is no rationality there unless you believe, as I do, that the New World Order really is about capital being able to move from place to place, sucking out as much wealth as possible in any given area, and then when there's nothing left, to simply move on. The capitalist and the communist idea reduce man solely to labor power, and the result of that is that everything in the world, therefore, is reduced to quantity. Dollars, votes, opinion polls, whatever it might be, everything is simply a matter of quantity. And both in Soviet Marxism and in Western capitalism, labor has no independence of action. And as the economy gets worse and worse, labor will be treated worse and worse because, as the slogan has it today, you're lucky that you have a job. And if you complain too much, we'll bring in immigrants or we will go to the third world and set up shop there. So when this stuff was being developed at the turn of the century, the situation has gotten much, much worse. And I don't think that anyone can take capitalism seriously, because they do not have an adversarial relationship to the state. They are two sides of the same coin. Capitalism uses the state to enforce its oligarchy. Capitalism uses the state to force its competitors out of business. Big business in America is subsidized by the state in terms of taxes, land grants, export guarantees. Walmart usually gets its land for free because local governments are so desperate to bring in new industry. Walmart receives tax breaks and export subsidies wherever it goes. So to think that there's this opposition that the libertarians claim exists between the state and capital is absurd. They work together. They work hand in glove. And they are not opponents, at least, you know, generally speaking. I think the guild socialist movement wanted to stress quality over quantity. They wanted a return to craftsmanship, the independent worker within the guild organization. Workers should have full control over their tools and the machines under which they work and on which they work. And really, the Coalites and the Towneyites had held that political and property rights are relative only to the welfare of the society as a whole. Private property, in the sense of the ownership and the domination of capital, can function and have a right to exist only so much as it assists the society around it, its workers, its society, and the progress of labor towards autonomy and self-control. So, to the extent that the banks control everything, political processes, mortgages, all kinds of investment, the society cannot be considered democratic. The word democracy is a word that is abused to the point of near mockery. And the minute someone like me begins to advocate democracy in the local level, is actually having some kind of power over things, democracy of the workplace, democracy in the creation of the guild and the craftsman association, suddenly that word doesn't sound so great anymore. Democracy exists for the regime only to the extent that they can manipulate it and control it and get the result that they wanted. When Montenegro was ordered by the European Union to declare its independence from Serbia, they had what we might call kangaroo elections. Most of the voters in Montenegro had boycotted it. A couple of times they had more than 50% turnout. They threw out the election results again and again and again, until they finally, after many tries, got the result that they wanted, and then suddenly there were no more elections. The structure of society within this movement very much comes from Pierre-Joseph Proudhon, a sort of a, what you might call a right-wing anarchist and federalist. Society is based and functions around actual functional groups. The individual is an abstraction, as I've said many times before. The individual is in and of himself completely helpless. Any society can only be understood through understanding its functions. It has to feed itself. It has to defend itself. It has to maintain certain public goods. It has to maintain a certain level of infrastructure and aesthetic enjoyment and all of these things that have to exist for a society to be a society. These are the functions that form, in the broad sense, the corporate movement and the syndicalist movement that you see in the early 19th century in George William Frederick Hegel, where social life in the upper house of the legislature is actually filled with representatives from these functional organizations. Now, Cole wants the guilds to be based on the various crafts and functions in human society, and in and of itself to be an authority for its members, not merely the state, being able to pass laws for its members, regardless of what the state may say, and ultimately that the state become, slowly but surely, one relatively minor function out of many. What's happening here is that the concept of revolution has been removed, and what's put in its place is the guild idea, the craftsmen's associations, other social, religious organizations, slowly taking more social power to itself over its members, and in the process creating many mini states within the state, having more or less their own juridical control over their members and functioning one with another in some sort of balance of power. So this has to be a gradualist movement as people get more and more socially active and begin to trust one another. Most Americans are not particularly active. Neighborhoods do not normally communicate one with another. And the result is a complete lack of trust. This lack of trust derives from a lack of proper socialization, the alienation that derives from the complete lack of any real kind of democratic control, in the best sense of the word, in the workplace. They have none, not only in the workplace itself, but also the economy as a whole, which is all powerful, and the average person or even the average town has absolutely no control over it. So if democracy is to be taken seriously, and it is not, but if it is, then some sense of worker control over industry by the guilds or some other association, independent and self-governed association, is absolutely necessary. But these guilds are based on quality. They're based on craftsmanship. And they represent an important function within any given society. And they're able to compete with the state and other social organizations for authority in that society. Credit is seen as a communal product. One of the things that G.D.H. Cole had advocated was the nationalization of the banks and finance. What's occurred in Western societies is that the state has been financialized. Bankers control the state in the sense that they control its credit, and they control campaigns. In the last election, both of the Goldman Sachs candidates, McCain and Obama, both received roughly $14 million from Goldman Sachs. So they control both parties, and so both parties are very much interested in continuing to bail them out. And ultimately, what's happening is the creation of self-governed guilds, the eventual understanding that the person that any kind of capital owner would have to deal with is a guild organization, not an individual. An individual up against capital is absolutely nothing. There is no contest there. But capital up against a guild who has legal authority to decide who will work in its particular area of competence, whether it be carpenters or electricians or whatever it happens to be, that is meaningful. And capital and the guild would meet as equals, which ultimately would be the destruction of the wage system. Most of the Christian socialists at the turn of the century were vehemently opposed to the wage system, in that wages should be based on expertise within the guild organization, structured around the traditions and methods that have worked over the years of the guild itself. So you have a legitimate sense of inequality, but that's based within the guild or the functional organization. In other words, the guild is receptive and communicative of the tradition of whatever it is that it represents. The tradition of being a good carpenter or being a good electrician derives from the tradition that has been laid down by the experts in the field. This is what the guild does. And only with that kind of standard can you make an intelligent judgment as to someone being better than another. A judgment is referencing a tradition of excellence within a particular field. That's how wages and payments deriving from the guild, not from the owner of capital. So this, you know, this isn't really a radical system, except in the sense that the guild socialist movement of G.D.H. Cole wanted a worker to have a representation within the guild organization itself, based around a tradition of excellence within the specific field. And that guild organization alone has the right to train and deploy labor who is expert in that field. Now, there's a lot of problems with this concept, but its primary benefit is that labor can then face capital as two equal partners, where today it is simply the alienated individual with very few resources up against capital who has all the resources. We need to remember the simple fact of what early industrialization was in Great Britain. It was a return to slavery. It was a return to factories actually owning its labor without any real ability to leave. Long hours, lots of accidents, lots of deaths, child labor. And this Christian socialist movement was one of the strugglers against child labor and the concept of a safe workplace. And we think of industrialization, we need to remember the sacrifice, quite literally the sacrifice is necessary for any kind of industrialized society in millions of deaths, either through wars or industrial accidents or the poisoning of the atmosphere or whatever it might happen to be. The community generates wealth, the community generates credit, and therefore the community should be paid. That principle, you read Hegel, is to be found in the guilds, in the corporations, and G.D.H. Cole, it is to be found in the guilds. Now, the ideal commonwealth, according to G.D.H. Cole, who eventually became a friend of Oswald Mosley, Cole was an eccentric. He was vehemently anti-Soviet, but of course equally anti-capitalist. And as I've shown on the show some time ago, the Cold War is largely mythology. I don't think there was a bolt or a nut in Soviet heavy machinery that was not manufactured in America or in Western Europe. Trade with the Soviet Union was huge, and her economic growth was based on its own parasitic dependence on West Europe and the United States. And the investment and the aid and assistance to the Soviet Union through private capital was huge. So Cole, like a lot of people on his side, viewed capitalism and communism as really one and the same thing, just differing over certain economic priorities globally. And the only real problem that the U.S. had with the Soviet Union was that it was creating its own trading bloc centered in Moscow. That was the main issue, certainly not the economic system. It was a Wilson administration who bailed out the Soviet system in its early years, who assisted the Bolsheviks with cash, and it was FDR who recognized the new society and began trading with it vigorously. And throughout the 1920s and 1930s, American heavy industry, automotives, agricultural industry, chemicals, electricity, these firms were heavily engaged in trade with the Soviet Union, and Soviet economic growth is largely based on constant American infusions of capital. So the rhetoric of the Cold War is largely nonsense. The Soviet Union was a major trading partner of the United States, and I want to say that that was the case, especially after World War II, and as the U.S. government is fighting in Korea and Vietnam, her corporations are trading briskly with the Soviets, who are financing the enemies of the Americans in Korea and Vietnam. The guild socialist or the Christian socialist idea is an attempt to give skilled labor, in particular, actual skills, useful skills necessary for the functioning of any society, an equal say in their negotiations with capital. And then one day, slowly but surely, the actual functioning of capital and how it works in how it circulates in a society or even internationally will be at least largely, partially, in the hands of skilled labor. The opposite of skilled labor here is not unskilled labor. The opposite of skilled labor here is the financiers and the speculators who control a massive amount of wealth in Western societies. Okay, let's take a break, and we will conclude this when we get back.
Don't go away, because there is more on the Orthodox Nationalist. This is VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. We'll be right back. Let's return to the Orthodox Nationalist, hosted by Matt Johnson.
Okay, everybody, welcome back to the Orthodox Nationalist. We are dealing today with guild socialism and Christian socialism as an alternative both to capitalism and communism in terms of economics. I think it was Pierre Proudhon who said it better than anybody else when he said the main ethical objection when he looks at modern societies is that there's a large group of people who seem to live parasitically off the labor and skills of others. That reality, which everybody, regardless of their particular point of view, they know it exists, and is probably the single most unnatural and bizarre state of affairs, where the sickness of an actual parasite functions eventually to weaken and destroy its host. And the parasites usually are very short-sighted, and their rationality does not extend any further than their next meal. If that is the social evil, at least economically speaking, the Christian socialist movement of the turn of the 20th century saw the guild as its, at least to a great extent, solution to the problem. The definition here that Cole and many others give is that a guild is self-governing. It is based on skill, and it's hierarchically organized according to actual ability. And it is functionally constituted. That is to say, that a guild actually has a socially useful function. It could be teachers. It could be law enforcement. It could be carpentry. It could be computer repair. It could be software programming. And the function isn't just the organization of people who have proven themselves in this skill, but also the training and the deployment of that skill in the society. And the idea is quality and a legitimate hierarchy. In this case, it's a hierarchy of actual ability given certain parameters. The things that all carpenters know, the things that all electricians know, these are the standards by which a guild can judge whether someone is better than another and therefore deserves more money. So when you use the tradition of an organization or a skill as the basis of assigning wealth within the guild organization, you have eliminated the wage issue and you have instituted a legitimate meritocracy. Guilds are to be mutually dependent. They're isolated and abstract by themselves. They have to be functional elements within the society. A carpenter can't work without the electrician who's able to supply power to his power tools. They exist in a legitimate functional organism. The central concept of the Christian socialist idea is that the individual, unless you're a billionaire, the individual is generally meaningless politically. My preferences or your preferences don't mean a damn thing relative to the government of the United States or the government of the state that you live in. Sometimes it doesn't mean anything in the government of the household that you live in. Now, George Soros's personal opinion does get immediately translated into political power and political authority. But that's the problem. The left and the socialists have no problem with this man, given his Jewish and leftist background, being able to translate his power or his desire into political power. And it's based exclusively on the fact that he is a currency speculator with billions of unearned dollars. He produces nothing. He is a parasite, and so are those like him. Hegel's solution to the problem in his philosophy of right is the idea of the guild or the corporation representing the functional aspects of any society to be represented ultimately through guild elections to the upper house of the legislature. My personal opinion is that the lower house should be based on proportional representation, and that any kind of Supreme Court organization needs to be highly limited in its power. The Supreme Court in the United States is probably the only institution that has no real functional check on its authority and its power, and can manipulate the meaning of the Constitution as it sees fit. I think ultimately the guild socialist movement at the turn of the century wanted to see workers' control over the industries in which they were employed. Now, worker control schemes have been around for a long time. They were used in Yugoslavia in the 60s and 70s. The problem is that, you know, these committee meetings and everything else often took up a lot of time. They were very dry, dealing with budgets and government regulations and things like that. And the average worker, after an 8-9 hour day, wants to go home, does not want to stay in the factory and debate budgets for 3 hours. And that becomes a problem. The alternative to that is for the guild to hire actual professionals who could deal with these questions, experts who can deal with these questions on behalf of the guild. But then you have the problem of their developing a new style of oligarchy. An oligarchy that is based around a professional politician or a bureaucratic expert who becomes detached from the working man that he is supposed to represent. All of these are legitimate problems, all of which, of course, exist to an extraordinary degree in modern capitalist societies. The system exists in such an oligarchic and evil way that it's hard to consider how any change in our direction might ever be for the worse. Even if guilds are capable of developing a professional political class that acts as its own oligarchy, that will be a fraction of the power of the actual living, breathing oligarchs in American and global society in 2011. The only good news is that, as Americans, we have nowhere to go but up. Think of it this way. One of the reasons that the West has been supporting the so-called uprisings in the Middle East. There are many reasons, but one of which is the existence and the expansion of Islamic banking. Islamic banking now is a multi-trillion dollar industry in Islamic societies. The Islamic banking idea has a lot in common with the turn of the century guild socialist idea. Both views are completely anti-interest. Interest, what we might call interest, can only be the actual profits and dividends from an industry that produces a useful thing. Interest is usury. Interest is immoral. This is a classic medieval idea that slowly but surely the Jewish merchant classes were to break down and create what we might call the Renaissance or the so-called Enlightenment. Instead, when you go to an Islamic bank for a loan, you have to provide, of course, like in any bank, a prospectus of what you plan to do and how this is to work. And the bank forwards you the money on the condition that the bank now becomes essentially your partner in this undertaking. And the bank gets paid out of the profits and the dividends of the enterprise. So there is nothing in this exchange that we can call actual interest. There's no interest at all. There is legitimate profit based on the provision of a usable resource, a good or a service. And the guild socialist movement at the turn of the century was exactly the same. An owner of capital, which I guess in some cases could be another guild or a social organization of one kind or another, can enter into a partnership for the creation of a certain good, that partnership we would call a company or a firm making something. And workers would be paid out of the dividends, the sales or whatever it would be, from that particular industry. Whether that be internally designed by the guild itself or externally designed by the actual profit of the company is a separate matter. But either way, the concept of interest has been eliminated. Production is the only thing that produces wealth, and therefore production is the only thing that produces actual dividends and payments. Islamic banking has taken over entire areas, including secular leaders, people like Saddam Hussein, people like Hafez al-Assad, people like Mubarak, people like Gaddafi. And the more religiously based monarchies in the Middle East are also heavy involved in Islamic banking. I think I said in a show a few weeks ago that Islamic banking had billions of dollars in, had millions of dollars in deposits. That's not true. It's well over $1 trillion now throughout the Middle East in places like Malaysia and Indonesia. It is a major force competing with the Rothschilds on the global stage. And since Islamic banking will not charge interest, but rather takes its share from the actual production, profits, and revenue, gross revenue of the firm, it has an interest in, and of course, a healthy economy, and has an interest in intelligent macroeconomic policies in general. And given the growth of Islamic societies, Islamic banking has grown to be a real-world, day-to-day competitor with the Rothschild movement. It is not a good day to be a member of the banking oligarchy, regardless of how much money you have, because Islamic banking had substantial branch offices throughout all of the areas that are now up in flames. And I think that goes far to explaining the uncritical financial, military, media, diplomatic support for these movements without any regard to what these movements might be demanding. All they know is a short-sighted idea that Islamic banking has pushed the Rothschilds and their allies out of the Middle East. And they're doing it on the basis of the much older guild socialist concept. Interest can be eliminated if the payments to labor, the payments to a banking institution, derive from the gross revenue of the firm that they help create, that they help run. And there is no reason why financial experts could not create something along the lines of a Christian banking guild that would function very similar to the Islamic banks. And now, on top of it, the Bank of the South, which is located in Caracas, no surprise, which is President Chavez's experiment in Latin America to create a truly nonpartisan, basically nationalist and Christian-based banking system in Latin America. And that has a lot to do with both liberals and conservatives joining hands in condemning Chavez, usually with the exact same litany of offenses as they condemn anyone who competes successfully with the Rothschild clan and their allies who control the banking industry as an oligarchy. So, anyway, that being said, let's summarize the basic concept here. We're talking about Christian socialism, guild socialism, a movement that developed in Great Britain among more or less right-wing socialist people who were basically conservative in their general social point of view and who saw capitalism and industrialism as destroying the fabric of traditional society. One of the great manipulations of history is that the regime has been able to cast socialism as this left-wing partisan movement when, in fact, its initial organization was very conservative, was Christian, religious, and agrarian at its root, and looked at capitalism being more or less the same thing as industrialization. And it needs to be kept in mind that in the academy, in institutions of higher learning throughout the world, the early Christian and Guild socialist ideas are rejected completely and not discussed in the classroom. Only Marx and what became, for lack of a better phrase, the Jewish International Socialist Movement, which sought the transference of all wealth to the hands of the party, and of course the party controlled the state. The real sort of libertarian communalist forms of socialism that you find in the Christians and the Guildists movements in Great Britain and elsewhere, the beginnings and really the height of industrialization, the smokestack industries of these places, these have all been thrown down the memory hole. And I will say this, and I'll say this again and again, the regime, the New World Order's greatest fear is for there to be a legitimate, real, populist, blue-collar, right-wing socialist organization that develops any kind of real membership. That would be more consistently relatively radical in its demands for worker control over industry and finance and the guilds and everything else, but of course be religious and more or less conservative in the true sense of the word, traditional and neo-medievalist, for lack of a better phrase, in social and cultural issues. If such an organization could be founded, it would win very big in elections, because it would be based exclusively around the ideas of justice. The individual is not the issue. The family is the issue. And a guild, in a certain sense, particularly in its local manifestations, would be the extension, by analogy, of the family. The locality, an extension of the family. The church and parish, the extension of the family. The ethnic group, an extension of the family. It is a group of overlapping communities having over time developed a basic functional balance of power. G.D.H. Cole was the intellectual founder of this movement, and the purpose of the guild was, number one, to train and judge workers in the tradition of the craft, number two, to represent workers in its dealings with capital, and more distantly, number three, to slowly but surely take control of capital and the functions of deciding where capital can best be employed for the sake of making a profit. And people would then be paid and receive dividends through the guild, not necessarily through the various firms that the guild might be working with. And of course, your benefits and everything else would either come from the state or, in the more Proudhonian point of view, would come from the guild itself. And even today, the Iron Workers Union is what pays the workers. The Iron Workers Union is where you have your health insurance and your pension and everything else. So G.D.H. Cole would take such an organization and make them, slowly, make them important economic actors that can represent workers in their dealings with either the state or capital or any other source and function of power within the society. Not too long ago, I was reading something by Anthony Wright, who is interested in the Guild Socialist idea, an article he put together in 1974. And I took some time to write the big differences and distinctions in the major issues between international socialism or Marxism, which sometimes I simply call Jewish socialism, because at least in its early years it was top-heavy with Jews, and the Christian socialism or the guild socialist idea that has now been successfully thrown down the memory hole. Needless to say, of course, the Jewish socialist and Marxist idea is anti-Christian, while the guild socialists are often a Christian, or in the case of the Islamic world, Islamic organizations. The proof that the Soviet government, in its persecution of religion, especially in its first 20 years of existence, didn't care that these religious bodies, in fact, were supportive somehow of capitalism, since the overwhelming majority of the religious groups that were repressed and sent to the camps by the Soviet Union in many ways were anti-capitalist and would have supported some kind of pro-Christian socialist government in Russia. The Old Believers, the many of the monasteries, the Ukrainian autocephalists. I mean, a lot of these groups were basically right-wing socialists who did not like the concept of the invasion of foreign capitalists trying to take advantage of the Russian market. The Soviets destroyed any institution that stood in its way. It had nothing to do with ideology. Ideology was merely a smokescreen. Marxist, of course, is materialist, while the Christian socialist is idealist. The state is central to Marxism, but it is the family that's central to the Christian socialist. One is urban, the other is rural. Marxism is technocratic, while the guild socialist is craft-oriented. Marxism is revolutionary. The guild socialist is really about peaceful development and evolution. The Jewish socialist worships himself and the party as the final end of history, while the guild socialist is about personal sacrifice and devotion. The Marxist is a statist. The other is, of course, anti-statist. The Marxist comes from Moses Hess and Feuerbach and Marx, while the guild socialist comes from Proudhon, Hegel, Rousseau. The Marxist is international, while the guildist has a tendency to look locally and regionally. There is no place for the market in Marxism, but there certainly is a place for a legitimate free market in the guild system, because the market alone is capable of deciding where capital can best be deployed in terms of making a profit. The guild idea is generally non-systematic, and it realizes that different areas will develop differently, and the balance of power amongst these organizations will differ. There is no blueprint there. Marxian socialism is purely political. Of course, the guild idea is basically economic and ethical. There's a huge difference between a collectivist movement and a communal movement. A collectivist movement is something that is imposed by the state, while a community is something that exists in line with nature and therefore the family. Marxian socialism is about quantity. Christian socialism is about quality. There was never any workers' control in the Soviet Union, nor were there any legal labor unions. That's more proof that the Soviets and communism in general had no interest in labor at all. It was about the transfer of wealth to the Jewish party. And yet the guild and Christian socialist idea is full workers' control wherever possible over industry via the guild or the trade union. For the Marxists, economics lies at the basis of everything. And this problem, which existed, of course, only in the modern era, that's the problem that needs to be overcome. Economics should not be at the base of everything. Though I will admit that the guild socialist does believe in some kind of labor aristocracy, but that's on the basis of skill and production, not, as in the Soviet system, how close you were to major party functionaries. The Jewish socialism centered itself around the persecution of all who disagreed with it, and of course there's nothing like that in the guild idea. The fact that the Soviets banned all trade unions that were formed in opposition to the state-run economy proves that this was about the party and the state controlling everything. It had nothing to do with labor. Jewish socialism is based around state ownership and therefore state control of the economy. The guild socialist idea isn't so much centered around the idea of ownership so much, but rather centers around the concept of control. Capital can be in the hands of a private investor or group of investors, but the guild would have to be negotiated with in order to get the workers to work the machinery. So therefore, they have to meet in the public realm as equals. So there you have an example where the worker does not own the machines necessarily that he is working on, but does have full control over the machines he's working on, given the power and the training and the prestige of whatever guild it is that has to be negotiated with in order to get the workers to work the machinery. So I'm going to say the opposite of socialism. The way that socialism functioned under the Marxist idea in Soviet Union, in Cuba, in North Korea, in China, in Cambodia. These kind of places are based on an ideology that we could call Marxism-Leninism or Jewish socialism or material, whatever it might be, international socialism, materialist socialism, whatever you want to call it. Its opposite is not capitalism. Its opposite is Christian socialism or some form of the guild socialist idea. We see it with Islamic banking and other institutions that take that basic point of view. And I have the feeling that something along these lines is going to have to be promoted and built in order for people who are neo-medievalists like myself or nationalists or communitarians of whatever kind for us to develop a serious economic agenda, an economic and labor-centered agenda against the New World Order, which is dedicated solely to oligarchy. Both communism and capitalism are identical in their view of mankind and in the concept of labor control. And so we have to develop this concept of really the opposite of the Enlightenment materialist idea, and that is a legitimate libertarian Christian socialism. That's my talk for tonight. I thank you for listening, everybody, and I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. The Orthodox Nationalist returns Thursday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. Time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
To Radio Aryan.